to the Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery fiction in 6 double issues a year. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In our podcast series, we bring you readings of short stories from the back issues of our magazine to give you a sense of what the magazine is about. For this episode, we have Kevin Egan reading his short story, Term Life, from our June 2014 issue. Kevin Egan has worked for many years as a law clerk in the Manhattan Supreme Court. The iconic courthouse serves as a setting for his legal thrillers, including his 2017 novel, A Shattered Circle, which, like the story you will hear today, features the court officer and sometimes fixer, Fox.
Fox slid across the bed enough to see Ellen standing at the stove and pan-frying something that smelled like onions. It had to be onions, Fox thought, because it wasn't eggs and the only other thing in the fridge suitable for frying was a big yellow Vidalia. Ellen moved to the sink, so Fox rolled onto his back and hung his head off the mattress to keep her in view. She wore one of his uniform shirts with his old holster hanging from her hips. She had nice hips. It was barely 7 p.m. and they already had made love twice. Now she was cooking omelets, and by 9 she would be working the late shift down at Artie's. Fox pinched his arms to make sure he hadn't died and gone to heaven. The phone rang. Fox rolled off the bed and went into the kitchen. The phone hung on an empty square of wall, below which once had been a table and chairs, but now was a patch of linoleum tiles, less faded than the rest. Fox checked the caller ID, then lifted the handset and dragged the cord back toward the bed.
Is this Fox?
The voice on the phone sounded weak and bubbly, as if speaking underwater. It is, said Fox. Judge Condon?
I need to see you.
Tonight?
Now.
Fox calculated his ETA if he departed at 9. How about...
Now, Fox, you promised.
Fox walked the phone back into the kitchen and hung it on the wall. Ellen stood at the counter, cracking eggs into a mixing bowl. He could tell from the slant of her shoulders and the angle of her head that she had listened to his conversation, not that she could have gleaned anything from half a dozen ambiguous words. He walked up behind her, circled her waist with his arms, pressed himself against his own shirt tail. "You need to go somewhere," she said, cracking another egg. "Afraid so. Sorry. An old obligation coming home to roost." Fox pulled up opposite Judge Condon's house, but did not get out of the car right away. The rain pounded and the wind lashed, and the few yellow leaves left on the front yard maples trembled, but somehow hung on. The house did not look like a judge's house. It was a brick cape with 3 white dormers poking through the roof. Unassuming, but then Judge Condon was an unassuming man. They had met many years earlier when the judge sat in Bronx Supreme Court. It had been a particular time in Fox's life. Fox waited for a let-up in the rain, decided there would be none, then sprinted across the street. The front stoop had an awning that gave no protection. He rang the doorbell, then turned up his collar and hunched his shoulders. A thick drop plopped on the top of his head, seeped to his scalp, and then rolled down the curve of his skull to the corner of his ear. From inside, he heard the squeak and rattle of metal wheels with hard rubber tires. A wheelchair, he thought. But then the door pulled back, and Judge Condon stood before him, wearing gray pajamas and a burgundy bathrobe. A clear plastic hose connected an oxygen clip to a cylinder hooked on a small hand truck.
"Good evening, Fox," said the judge.
Fox hung his dripping jacket on a wooden coat tree.
"Hell of a night out there," the judge said. "Sorry, but I couldn't plan for this. Otherwise, I would have picked an evening in June, midsummer's night, with the light lingering on the horizon."
"Would have been drier," said Fox. "Warmer, anyway." Water puddled on the tiles beneath his jacket.
"Don't worry about that," said the judge.
He spun the hand truck across the foyer and into a small den. A woman in white nursing scrubs arranged 2 plates of food on snack tables set up in front of a pair of chairs facing a flat-screen TV. She moved one of the tables enough to allow the judge to settle in and park the hand truck beside him. She was a pretty lady, Fox noticed. Her wavy blonde hair pulled back from a heart-shaped face, her small eyes placed perfectly between a high forehead and a delicate chin. A Renaissance angel, he thought. She nodded at Fox, then went through the dining room and into the kitchen. The swinging door slapped twice, then closed. Fox took the other chair. The judge aimed the remote at the TV, raising the sound on a basketball game. His hands were liver-spotted, thick-veined. The hair on his head, white blonde during his halcyon days on the bench, was now just white and wispy. He pressed a finger to his lips and leaned hard across the chair toward Fox.
"You have just met the woman who has come to kill me," he said.
Fox's father worked as a cook at the reformatory prison on Hart Island. Each morning he crossed the broken pavement of the dead-end street that separated their cottage from the dock and boarded the launch that ferried him to the prison. He rode the launch in all types of weather, from placid June mornings when the sound was as flat as glass, to violent November evenings when northeast gales whipped up whitecaps. He never missed a day, at least not in the soft focus of Fox's memory. And Fox often heard his father say on dismal mornings when his mother tried to coax him into staying home, "But Cecilia, how will the boys eat?" He never referred to his charges as inmates or prisoners or delinquents. They were always the boys. His father was retired for 1 week before he felt the slight twinge of pain in his stomach. Indigestion, he said at first. A passing virus, he explained a week later. An ulcer, he allowed after a month. When he finally went to the doctor a month after that, the answer was none of the above. The year that his father took to die coincided with the year Fox was assigned as court officer to Judge Condon in Bronx Supreme Court. Fox never arrived late and rarely called in sick, but he spent huge portions of each day distracted or preoccupied. Long before cell phones, he would seat the jury and then drift away from the courtroom to find an empty office with a working phone. From there, he would go down his list of daily calls. At first, the list included doctors, pharmacies, healthcare insurers. But as his father's health deteriorated, the list changed to visiting nurses, home health aides, social workers, hospice. One day, not finding an empty office or a working phone, he circled back to the judge's robing room. The judge was holding a hearing of some kind. Fox never troubled himself with the specifics of what occurred in the courtroom. And through the door, he could hear the stentorian tones of the lawyers mixed with the staccato rhythm of Judge Condon peppering them with questions. The voices faded as Fox delivered his litany. "How can this be? Why is this so? You haven't tried this? I want you to try that." He was arguing with a sales rep at a surgical supply house when he dimly became aware of someone watching him. Rather than look up, he physically screwed himself behind the desk, hunching his shoulders, bending his neck, shading his eyes. When the sales rep slammed down the phone, not an uncommon end to one of these calls, Fox looked up. Judge Condon loomed over him. "We need to talk," said the judge. "This is it," thought Fox. "I'm done." The judge finally noticed I don't give a damn. He'll turn me in, write me up, have me transferred to a judge handling arraignments or felony trials. He started to get up. He was sitting in the judge's own desk chair. But the judge told him not to move. He sat sideways on the desk, loosened the collar of his robe. "I know what's going on," he said. "I know what you're going through, and I've kept my mouth shut because it's none of my business. But now that I've stood here and heard what I heard, I need to tell you what I think, okay?" Fox gave the barest nod. "Your job is not to hector or cajole," said the judge. "Your job is not to pound the table and demand that doctors do this or do that. It makes no difference. There is no cure. There is no other ending. Your job is to get your father to the other side in as comfortable and as dignified a manner as you can. That's your job, pure and simple." Fox dropped his knife and fork onto his plate. What do you mean, he said.
What do you mean, what do I mean, said the judge. How many shades of meaning can that have? She's going to kill me. Tonight, I will not see the sun rise.
Fox pushed his plate as far away as the snack table allowed.
It's not the food, if that's what you're thinking.
The judge looped the oxygen hose over his shoulder and out of his way.
Don't let this fillet go to waste.
Fox sighed. He centered the plate, picked up his fork, tested a small bit of mashed potato with the tip of his tongue. The judge carved a piece of meat, chewed it with his mouth open, swallowed hard. You need to explain this to me, said Fox. The judge carved off a second piece of meat. This time, as he chewed, he raised the volume of the TV even louder. Then he told Fox everything. It was a bad deal, said Fox. He gambled. He lost.
I stacked the deck, said the judge.
Money and life are not equivalent. I could stop this.
That's not what I want.
You want to die?
In a manner of speaking, yeah. I have more troubles than Job, and I'm glad to be done. My family's gone. Most of my friends are gone. I can't run, can't walk. Can't even climb stairs to my own bed. Moot point, anyway. I lie down. I feel like I'm going to drown. So I sit here all night with my feet on the ottoman. I fall asleep, wake up, watch some TV, then fall asleep again.
How much longer do you have?
Doctors say a year. Not a pleasant one.
Still, said Fox, with life all things are possible.
You mean with God all things are possible, said the judge. With life, we have the probable and the actuarial. I don't regret what I did. My daughter was sick. She'd been fired from her job. Had no money to pay for her treatments. I'd do it all over again without a second thought. But time has come. We must honor our contracts, even the bad ones. Because otherwise, what kind of civilization do we have? What kind of judge would I be to renege after I've taken the benefits and don't have the simple decency to meet my obligation?
You mean the simple decency to die on schedule? The judge shrugged. What exactly do you want me to do, said Fox.
First we'll finish dinner, said the judge. Then we'll have dessert and coffee. After dessert, you will leave and sit in your car. I expect it will happen when she brings the ottoman and the blanket and tucks me in for the night. Something quick, painless, untraceable. Though God knows there's no call for an autopsy for someone with my diagnosis.
That's all you want of me, to sit outside?
No. There's more.
The rain changed to snow, the big flakes lingering on the windshield before melting away. Fox slouched in his seat and folded his arms across his chest. In the mirror, he could see the aide's car in the driveway, the judge's front door, the den window with the TV light flickering behind the shades. The big flakes got smaller and began to stick on the strip of grass between the sidewalk and the curb. It was a neat neighborhood. Soon, the den window shades went dark. Fox checked his watch, realizing that back on City Island, Ellen would be long gone from the cottage. It was the first thought he gave her since the judge told his story. The judge had come to his father's wake. He was a different man back then, strong and healthy, with an arsenal of jokes he delivered with the timing of a Borscht Belt comedian. The perfect mourner at an Irish wake. You were right, Fox said to him at the end of the evening. My job was to get him to the other side. The judge clapped a hand on Fox's shoulder and lowered his eyes, the wit that launched a thousand laughs poignantly stilled. I can't thank you enough, said Fox, if I ever can help you. Fox heard the siren an hour later. It was just a hint at first, but it quickly mounted, and then strobe lights licked the trees at the end of the street, and then the ambulance itself bore down on the judge's house. The aide stood on the front stoop as the EMS tech swung down and unloaded an orange gurney and black suitcases. Along the street, people drifted out of their houses. They stood on the sidewalk, bundled in bathrobes and hunched against the snow, then slowly went back home. 45 minutes after the ambulance arrived, the techs carried out the suitcases and the gurney. On the gurney lay a shroud, all the proof Fox needed. He followed the ambulance to the end of the street, then wheeled in the opposite direction. The address the judge had given him turned out to be a seedy Art Deco building in White Plains. Fox well knew the types of lawyers who rented space here. They were the lawyers who barely scraped by doing the work more successful lawyers felt beneath them, like answering cattle call calendars in big city courthouses or appearing in far-flung night courts on small claims cases. The lobby directory showed the name and a seventh-floor office. Everything about the elevator was slow. It was slow to descend from the fifth floor, slow to settle at the lobby level, slow to open its doors. Fox got on, pressed 7, and prepared to wait. Just as the door finally began to close, a man got on. "Getting into the elevator," he said into a cell phone. "Talk to you later." He dropped his briefcase, eyed the 7 lit up on the panel, then eyed Fox. He was a portly man, bald at the top, but with stylishly long gray hair on the sides. At the 7th floor, the man politely let Fox exit first. They walked down the same corridor, stopped in front of the same door. "Are you looking for me?" said the man. The name on the door read William Pickwick, Esquire. "I am," said Fox. Pickwick unlocked the door, reached in to flip the light switch, then ushered Fox inside. "Well," he said, shedding his raincoat, "what can I do for you, Mr. Fox, I'm here about a contract." "You'll need to be more specific, Mr. Fox. My practice involves all manner of contracts and contractual relationships. Is it an existing contract you wish to enforce? Is it a potential contract you wish to negotiate? It's one of those that involves, you know, life insurance?" "Yes," said Fox. "Well, there's no need to be coy, Mr. Fox. Are you talking about your own life insurance policy?" Fox tilted his head midway between a nod and a shake, leaving the interpretation to Pickwick. "Funny, you look too healthy to be interested." "Looks are deceiving," said Fox. "What I have will kill me, never fails." "In that case, why don't we sit down? It will take me maybe half an hour to walk you through the process. What is the face value of your policy?"
$500,000.
"Really? Term, I assume, because I only deal with term life insurance policies." "Yes, it's a term policy," said Fox. "Can't afford anything else." Pickwick led Fox into his private office, tightly furnished with a desk, 3 chairs, and 2 banks of file cabinets. He unlocked 1 cabinet, rolled open the top drawer, and lifted out a sheaf of papers. A small card attached to the drawer was hand-lettered with the words, "Viatical K's."
"Funny word," said Fox.
"What?"
said Pickwick.
He followed Fox's eyes. "Oh, that. K is a long school abbreviation for contract. So that means viatical contracts."
"Funny word," said Fox.
"What?" said Pickwick.
He followed Fox's eyes.
"Oh, that. K is a law school abbreviation for contract. So that means viatical contracts."
He laid the papers on the desk to face Fox. A pen appeared in his hand, and he tapped it on the blank lines at the top of the page. "The viator's name goes here," he said, "and my name, as the purchaser, goes here. You know what a viator is?"
Fox shook his head.
"A viator is a terminally ill life insurance policyholder. Understand?" Fox nodded. "So the way it works is this. I buy the viator's life insurance policy at a discounted amount. The viator gets that money up front without needing to die and without paying any more premiums, which I then assume the duty to pay. In return, the viator executes an assignment directing payment of the death benefit to me."
"And how much do you pay the viator?" said Fox.
"Depends on several factors. The face value of the policy and the amount of the monthly premiums are 2 obvious ones. Then there is the actuarial factor, or the viator's life expectancy. That is determined by age, by the specific disease afflicting the viator and the stage that disease has reached. How do you figure that? Said Fox. The viator completes this application. Pickwick laid a second, thinner sheaf of papers in front of Fox. It includes an authorization allowing me access to all medical records. Fox arched an eyebrow. You speak theoretically of the viator, but you refer to yourself as the purchaser, or are you actually the attorney representing the purchaser? I am the purchaser, said Pickwick. I refer to a theoretical viator because I cannot presume that you would complete the application or that I would accept it. Why wouldn't you? Said Fox. Fraud, said Pickwick. It happens. Not very often, but it happens. Viators have misrepresented their conditions to my detriment. Meaning the viator lived too long? Meaning I paid more premiums than I expected, is the precise way of putting it. I may be doing good work by allowing the terminally ill to cash in on an asset that otherwise would be worthless to them, but this is a business, not a charity. What happens when a viator lives too long? I lose money, Pickwick smiled. But for every viator who lives longer than predicted, there is always the cancer patient who gets hit by a car or the HIV patient who dies of a heart attack. What about a viator killed by lethal injection? I'm sorry, said Pickwick. I don't understand. I'm talking about a viator who outlives his life expectancy, significantly outlives his life expectancy, and so a home health aide shows up to cut your losses. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about what happened to old Judge Condon tonight, said Fox. Pickwick began to gather up the papers. I think it's time you left this office. Fox grabbed Pickwick's wrist and yanked him across the desk. He pulled a set of handcuffs from his belt, slapped one cuff on Pickwick and the other on the arm of a chair. The chair was solid and heavy. Pickwick sprawled on his desk like a beached walrus, without the strength or the leverage to roll over or lift himself off. "Who are you?" he said. "I told you, my name is Fox. I'm an old friend of Judge Condon. Owed him a favor." "I don't know who you are talking about. I don't know what you are talking about. I'm an honest businessman plying an honest trade. My contracts have been held up in court dozens of times. You may not like my work, but I provide a service for people in need." "Until you decide to dispatch them," said Fox. "I don't know what you're talking about. I never, never interfere with any of my viators." "Right," said Fox. The door to the outer office opened. "Bill," said a woman's voice. "Nancy," Pickwick yelled. "Run!" But Fox was too quick, grabbing her before she could flee the office. She still wore her nursing whites beneath her black parka, still had her hair pulled back from her heart-shaped face, still looked like a Renaissance angel. Fox dragged her into the private office and shut the door. He had no other cuffs, so he sat her in one empty chair and wedged the other up against the doorknob. Pickwick squirmed on the desk. "He lied to me," he said. "That bastard lied to me. He knows doctors. He falsified his medical records. He should have died 6-8 months ago." "He defrauded you, right?" said Fox. "Yes, he defrauded me. See, you understand." "Why didn't you sue him?" "Sue him," said Pickwick. "You say your contracts have been held up in court dozens of times." "Sue a judge? A retired judge?" said Pickwick. "Who would hear the case? One of his old cronies? What chance would I have?" "No worse a chance than he had tonight." Fox pulled Nancy out of her chair and forced her to lie on the desk beside Pickwick. "What are you going to do?" she said, a fearful quaver in her voice. "Just keeping you two secure," said Fox. He unlocked the cuff attached to the chair and closed it around Nancy's ankle. Then he unfurled a large green garbage bag from his jacket pocket. He went to the file cabinet and emptied the drawers labeled Viatical K's into the bag. "That's my property," said Pickwick. "You can't steal those contracts. There are laws." "And there are lawyers," said Fox. He swung the bag over his shoulder, kicked the chair away from the door, and walked out. The elevator was slow in coming and slow in taking him down. The bag was heavy, and the sharp edges of the file folders began to poke through the green plastic. He was prepared. If anyone got on and asked him what was in the bag, he would say, "The Pickwick Papers." But he doubted anyone read Dickens nowadays. Anyway, no one got on, so he kept his witticism to himself. Fox was to deliver the contracts to a lawyer who would force Pickwick to rescind the deals and allow the Viators to keep the money and their policies. The judge wanted it to end that way because he believed that you needed to hit someone like Pickwick where it hurt the most, in the pocketbook. The elevator finally settled and the door opened on the empty lobby. Through the glass entry doors, the snow swirled thick. Fox stepped off, then back on again. The end Judge Condon had scripted felt vaguely unsatisfying. Fox dropped the garbage bag in the outer office. Still cuffed wrist to ankle, they lay where they had tumbled off the desk. Pickwick's forehead was badly bruised. Nancy's arm was bent and swollen. Fox reached over them, punched a number on the desk phone, and waited for the connection. "Medical examiner," said the voice.
Thank you, Kevin Egan, for reading Term Life. The story was published in the June 2014 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published 6 times a year by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of our managing editor, Jackie Sherbo, and editorial assistant, Kevin Wheeler. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.